The presenting sponsor of Food Safety Matters is Michigan State University. Food safety is a priority, and food safety professionals like you need the most up-to-date information on topics such as food security, food packaging, and emerging foodborne pathogens. Michigan State University offers a Master's of Science in Food Safety, 100% online, which will help you develop critical thinking, increase your understanding of food safety science, and advance your leadership skills, putting you and your company at the forefront of food safety. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the Master's Program link to learn more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and as usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Adrian Bloom, editorial director of Food Safety Magazine, and Bob Ferguson, president of Strategic Consulting. So, happy podcasting day, you guys.
Happy podcasting day.
Howdy.
So for today's episode, we've got a really interesting discussion with Dr. Guangtao Zhang, director of the MARS Global Food Safety Center, which is a state-of-the-art research and training facility designed to help tackle the most significant food safety challenges facing the planet today, including mitigation and control of mycotoxin and microbial risks, as well as improvements around food integrity. And just in case there's any question, I mean Mars, like Mars candy.
The Mars.
Like the Mars, mm-hmm. Is that it?
Yeah.
The Mars company.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're going to get to hear about the center's work in several key areas of food safety. And during this interview, we're also going to talk a little bit about how climate change is impacting some of these areas of food safety, which, you know, I think that's a timely topic considering that we've just celebrated Earth Day.
Well, perhaps it's time to mention that we are actually recording this on Earth Day. So we're feeling that. We're definitely
yep.
tuning in to
right.
to to mom's energy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Being Mother Earth and all.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to get to the news in just a jiffy. But I want to take this last opportunity to remind everyone that you can still register for the Food Safety Summit. Produced by Food Safety Magazine, and we will be in person May 9th through the 12th in Rosemont, Illinois. We're all getting really excited and inundated with a lot of emails as we get things organized down to the last detail, because we want it to be just right for everybody. We hope that you'll come and reconnect with your food safety colleagues, you know, because a lot of folks have already signed up. So I do need to say that we're pacing really well. It's going to be a strong showing in Rosemont. So, but we also want you to reconnect with us at Food Safety Magazine and, of course, Food Safety Matters podcast. Our booth is going to be located in the very center or the heart of the exhibit floor, as I like to think of it, under in the community hub, under kind of the big top, there's a big round community hub thing, and we're going to be right there, and really looking forward to seeing everybody again. So come on, we've missed you. Come see us. We've missed you so much. The conference, as always, has an excellent lineup of topics and speakers. You can check out all the sessions, workshops, and training courses we're offering by visiting foodsafetysummit.com. Now, it is late in the game, but you, dear podcast listeners, can still save 10% on registration fees. I know, it's
still?
Kind of miraculous. Yes,
still.
This is nice. The thing. These are among the many benefits of being a listener of Food Safety Matters. Because nobody else is getting this discount now. Everybody else is, you know, out of luck, as they say. I guess at this point we can say we're offering a late bird discount.
The late bird still gets the worm.
The late birds, if you are a podcast, late bird podcast listener still gets something, right?
Yeah.
So you need to use the code FSMPODCAST when you register. Visit foodsafetysummit.com to get all the details and use the FSM podcast code to save 10% on registration. And we really do hope to see you there. All right. So Adrian. What's news, Adrian?
Yeah, so first up in our news lineup, we have a couple of interesting studies on E. coli to share with you. Now, this first study that we're going to talk about was conducted by scientists from FDA's Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition and also USDA's Agricultural Research Service. And what it did was looked at how E. coli growth in lettuce is affected by many factors, including the season of harvest, shelf life, and storage temperature. Now, the aim of this study was to better understand the factors that can contribute to outbreaks of Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, or STEC, in processed bagged romaine lettuce. It was also expected to help fill knowledge gaps in FDA's Leafy Greens STEC action plan. Now, the scientists used whole genome sequencing to investigate the bacterial microbiome and STEC colonization of the fresh-cut lettuce with four variables in play: whether the lettuce was harvested in spring or autumn, and whether the lettuce was stored in cold or warm temperatures. Now, the results of the study suggest that seasonality, shelf life, and storage temperature all affect STEC growth in lettuce. Some notable findings were that high storage temperature contribute to rapid growth of STEC, and also elevated CO2 levels in packaging encourage STEC multiplication. Also, autumn harvesting was more favorable to STEC survivability than spring harvesting. And in the sample with short shelf life, STEC survived better in cold storage temperatures. Now, FDA hopes that the research from this study will help the agency combat foodborne illness outbreaks from leafy greens going forward.
Yeah, Adrian, this was a study, of course, about E. coli, but they really looked at the microbiome and also the elements of modified atmosphere packaging, or MAP, and what happened with the packaged E. coli and how that affected the 0157 that they found. The conclusion that they came to was the microbiome of the lettuce changed based upon the harvesting date and the components of what atmosphere they used and the amount of CO2 that they used. So this is really going to affect not only the tracing going back to when it was harvested, but also the type of atmosphere that they're going to use in that package. But it was really the change in the microbiome that affected the E. coli growth. It wasn't, at least other than the temperature, from what I could tell, it wasn't the effect on the E. coli itself, but the environment around it. And the microbiome that they saw in the spring was different from the fall. So something is happening to the lettuce as it grows later in the season. And that microbiome that surrounds the E. coli is allowing it to grow or certainly survive longer. So it's an interesting idea. It's the other bacteria that are causing the E. coli to persist.
Yeah, definitely interesting, Bob, what we saw there with that study. And, you know, so we have a second study that focuses on E. coli, and that one looked at the evolution of STEC strains over a period of 23 years. And so for that one, USDA's Agricultural Research Service observed 181 different STEC 0157H7 strains to learn how these strains evolve over time and also to give context for strain relatedness in foodborne illness outbreaks. So in this study, scientists collected STEC specimens from a closed system feedlot at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center. All 181 strains were put through short read sequencing and 36 were subjected to long read sequencing. Now, among the results of this study were that diverse subpopulations of STEC 0157H7 can coexist in the same small ecological environment and that strains can survive for a long time in the same feedlot. And by examining different groups or clades of STEC, the scientists found that groups tend to evolve at different rates. This suggests that the rate of evolution between the E. coli strains can vary even within serotypes and closed environment. The study also compared its findings with other data to examine the results in a broader food safety perspective. These comparisons suggested that algorithms for foodborne illness outbreak investigations are reproducible and can be applied to other investigation models.
Now, this one I'm going to call some deep science. This was quite a paper to try to read, and the type of sequencing that they did was fairly detailed. So first off, I want to send kudos out to Bailey Henderson, our digital editor, the way she summarized it on the website. She did it better than I could do it, I can tell you that, because this was some pretty real science. One of the things that they found was that the evolution of E. coli in the feedlot, and it was an isolated feedlot. There's not a lot of cattle that come in and out that would mix up the evolution of the bacteria, that the E. coli evolution progressed faster and in unexpected ways. And understanding this may lead to better pathogen tracking, looking at the very, very small changes in the sequences of the E. coli. They were down to looking at what are called SNPs, or single nucleotide, single letter changes within the whole genome sequencing. But when we think about things like recalls and matching the bacterial sources based upon whole genome sequencing, being able to track this is going to help them look at that fingerprint a little bit more accurately. So that's really what I got from that.
Is this having to do with simply E. coli as it relates to the animal welfare, or then again, is it affecting, you know, crops and things like that? Was there anything in there about survivability outside of that, or just how it works there and then possibly as it is on the animal and how that goes through to meat?
So from what I read, the interesting thing about this feedlot is it doesn't have a lot of cows coming in and out like you might with a commercial feedlot. And they'll bring in their own strains, and those strains will mix between the animals and amongst themselves as well. This feedlot was relatively isolated, so they could look at the evolutionary forces on the E. coli without any other outside forces, was the way I understand what they were doing. Mm. So they were really looking at the changes themselves, not any evolutionary changes driven by something else.
Mm-hmm. Or how it affects beyond the feedlot, or what happens next, either for meat or for spreading to agriculture.
Right. And they emphasize that this will help guide some of the tracing that they do, because these small changes are what identifies the E. coli from this feedlot from another feedlot. And if they can look at how it changes on its own, they can mm-hmm. see that, you know, maybe an E. coli that has a fingerprint of this one and it moves a little bit slightly, that this will help them say, yes, that's still the same feedlot because the evolution is moving faster. I think that's what they meant, and that's what I got from it. So this is deep bacterial genetics.
So you notice my deep silence, really. That's what I have to bring to this, is deep silence. thank goodness they're doing the work, right?
Yeah. I think it's very interesting, and I think it just helps us understand, you know, how the E. coli strains can change and evolve over time. And if you understand that, then you can understand what happens in different settings, maybe, you know.
Exactly.
So. Mm-hmm. So, and for our last bit of news, we'd like to draw your attention to a white paper from the Association of Food and Drug Officials, or AFDO, on recall modernization, and that was recently released. So that white paper, titled Recall Modernization, Accelerated Partnering for Effective Recalls, asks FDA to look at new ways to regulate and carry out food recalls. It also provides recommendations for modernization of recall practices based on 3 years of recall data gathered by a work group of regulators and industry representatives that was established in 2018. So in crafting these recommendations, AFDO looked at two fundamental recall issues. The first is the consumers continue to eat recalled foods and become ill. And the second is that recalls are issued too late to prevent additional illnesses from happening. The biggest focus for AFDO in this white paper is the timely removal of product from the market, which they say will require greater partnership and coordination between FDA and states. Specifically, AFDO stresses the need to establish clear expectations for roles and responsibilities with partners in recall events, and also the need for information sharing between regulatory partners. AFDO hopes that FDA and other parties involved in recalls will use the white paper to update their policies, strengthen information sharing and communication transparency, provide law and guidance training, and build effective partnerships.
This one was fascinating, and this one came out to me as a white paper that should be required reading for anyone in food processing, because they talk about the process of how they go through recalls, and Adrian mentioned it pretty well, that AFDO wants to focus on removing recalled product from the shelves, and that's harder than it seems. And I was surprised at some of the things that they said in the white paper. The one thing I'll focus on is they made a number of issues about communications between the FDA, the states, local authorities, on how they communicate with the processor and how they communicate to talk to the processor working through the recall. They made a couple of examples of where the FDA and the states will be calling the processor directly because they're not necessarily cooperating with each other. There's some lack of definition of the roles. And what happens is the person at the processor is answering calls from all these different people answering the same questions, when if that were consolidated in a better way, it'd be much more efficient. They also mentioned something, and this was the first time I knew about this, something called the FDA 2088 agreements. To make this short, it's a part of the FDA regulations where the FDA is required to allow confidentiality for some things that are key confidential information that the processor has to release. And it turns out that the FDA can't even release that to the states. One of the things that they can't release to the states is if it's considered a commercially confidential item, they can't release the company's distribution channels. So now the state is going out to say, let's get these off the market, but no one can tell them where they are. And the FDA knows that, but they can't tell the states. So that was a log jam on a lot of the communication back and forth. Some of the things they mentioned on communication was the usual silos and things, but there are some serious issues about that prevent people from talking to each other and prevent people from working to get the product off the shelf. That was fascinating.
Yeah, we've heard that we've covered that. I know we've talked about that in depth about the distribution channels, right? And protecting that is that's been a roadblock on this in past recalls, and frustrating when you're trying to protect people.
Yeah.
So this also, when we read this, it was like, well, that sounds familiar. And it sounds familiar to us because back a few months ago, we did a podcast with AFTO and Stop Foodborne Illness. That would be our episode 108 for those playing at home. And it's called Joining Forces for Recall Modernization. It's a great interview, great discussion with Mitzi Baum from Stop Foodborne Illness and two colleagues from AFTO, Steve Mondernack, and I'm not practice on Jennifer Piarki. Is that it? I think I got it. From AFTO. So a great in-depth discussion on their position and their talking points and their lobbying with really trying to work with FDA in the light of the new era of smarter food safety to improve things. So check out that episode. All right. So as usual, we will provide links to all the references that we've mentioned here in our news section. And we also want to remind you to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. Or you can take a deeper dive into all the great content that we offer by visiting our website, food-safety.com, where you can see some more of the great stories at Bailey Henderson. Our new digital editor is providing on a daily. I mean, Bailey is very busy and doing a great job. And now it's time for Adrian's interview with Dr. Guangtao Zhang, director of the Mars Global Food Safety Center. And in this role, he leads a global team of experts, all dedicated to ensuring safe food for all by addressing some of the most pressing food safety challenges impacting the global food supply chain. Dr. Zhang drives progress in food safety through the center by focusing on rigorous research, collaboration, and training in order to generate new capabilities, technologies, and solutions in critical areas of food safety. As part of this work, he has contributed to over 40, he's been busy too, peer-reviewed publications and 5 patents advancing capabilities in food safety science and application. Dr. Zhang has shared insights externally at several international conferences in a range of key areas in food safety research. Dr. Zhang has a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry from the University of Science and Technology of China and a master's and PhD in organic chemistry from the University of Washington. He joined the Mars Global Food Safety Center in 2015 as Analytical Food Safety Manager and became head of research in 2018 and then became director in January of 2021. So, after a quick break, we're going to hear that interview. Michigan State University is leading the way in food-related education and research. This Big Ten institution offers an MS degree in food safety, taught completely online and designed for you, the working professional. Courses are designed to be flexible, applicable, and students can tailor their electives to include coursework in food law, packaging, or public health. This degree program will increase your depth of knowledge in food safety and help prepare your company for any food safety challenges. Visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more.
Well, I am here today with Dr. Guangtao Zhang, the director of the Mars Global Food Safety Center. Today, we'll be discussing the center's work and partnerships and how its research is helping advance food safety. So, Dr. Zhang, welcome to the show. We're very happy to have you here.
Thank you, Adrian. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So, first of all, I want to ask you, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Mars Global Food Safety Center? You know, when and why was it established, and what kind of work is carried out there? And also, how does this work contribute to both pre-competitive industry knowledge and to Mars's corporate mission?
To answer your question, Adrian, I really want to start from who we are. Mars is a privately owned company with a history of over 100 years. Quality is our first principle, and food safety has a lot to do with it. We believe everyone has the right to safe food. Yet global food safety challenges are increasing with existing and emerging threats. 1 out of 10 people fall ill of eating contaminated food each year. That means 420,000 people die as a result. For businesses, that means $95 billion in loss of productivity was caused each year to low and middle income economies. And this is further exacerbated by climate change and other factors. We see there is a clear need to establish a center of expertise where people from academia, industry, NGO can work together and solve food safety challenges together. And that's why we opened the Mars Global Food Safety Center in September 2015, a state-of-the-art research and training facility designed to help tackle the most significant food safety challenges facing the planet today. The challenge really include mitigate and control mycotoxin and microbial risk, and also improve food integrity. So we are already generating new insights, driving technology breakthrough, and improve food safety capabilities and methodologies. As a result, we are taking a pre-competitive approach. It is rooted in original research, knowledge sharing, and collaboration, because we know food safety is too big of a task for any single entity to tackle. This pre-competitive approach will really allow us to openly share insights and expertise to help raise the bar and ensure safe food for all.
That's fantastic. It sounds like, you know, some very admirable work is being done there. And certainly, you know, with, you know, as you said, food safety is not something that can be achieved by one entity alone. So the fact that you have all these partnerships going, and I know you're going to speak about that a little later, and the fact that you're also doing training. So, you know, spreading your knowledge, you know, out further beyond the walls of the Global Food Safety Center. That's fantastic that, you know, you're reaching out in all directions. So very good to hear. Now, as director for the Mars Global Food Safety Center, what are your main areas of responsibility?
That's a very good question. The way I look at it, my responsibility can be summarized by three words: strategy, people, and application. Let's talk about strategy first. I am responsible for the designing and implementation of food safety strategy of the Global Food Safety Center, and that contribute to the broad Mars food safety strategy. By working together with our partners and collaborators, we align on resources and deliverables so that we can achieve our corporate purpose, which is create a better world tomorrow. I just want to give you a broad sense of what that strategy really covers, right? It's about how do we position ourselves for the future success, looking at a 3 to 5 year horizon. And it is also covering the fact that we will invest heavily in food safety research and implementation. Last but not least, it's about leveraging the resources, partnership, and collaboration to create value. And that's strategy. The second part is about people. Needless to say, I have a team of 30-plus talented and dedicated food safety researchers spanning 5 countries, and 44% of them are PhDs. I think what is really unique about the Global Food Safety Center is we have an internal mentorship program so that we ensure everybody has a chance to develop their career. Last but not least, application. So that is really the question I ask myself constantly. How can we collectively maximize the value of the innovation for people and the planet? This could mean, you know, convert our basic research into tangible business applications, solutions that they can actually use. It also means we can publish on peer-reviewed journals with open access so that everybody can read it. The output didn't stop there. We constantly go to international conferences, open forums, and share our research outcome. Beyond that, we also work with NGOs and also regulators to help them develop science-based regulation. On a personal note, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm really, really passionate about what I do. First of all, I got to work with a group of very talented and passionate people. They are very capable, and we share the same goal. It's about the fundamental issue in people's food, ensuring their food safety. What is more relevant than that? We are looking at something that we can truly make a difference. And ultimately, we want to improve people's quality of life.
That's fantastic. It sounds like you have a really wonderful team, you know, behind you and are working with, you know, a lot of extremely knowledgeable experts, you know, around the world. And it's great that you have, you know, kind of satellite teams as well, because, you know, the more people you have in different locations, the more the knowledge is dispersed and shared, right? So
that's... Yeah, the diversity is truly amazing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, as you said before, when you were talking about the center's main purposes, I know that you focus on 3 main areas of food safety. You focus on mycotoxin risk management, microbial risk management, and food integrity. So I'm curious, what particular elements of mycotoxin risk management is the center focused on? And how is this related to human health and also climate change?
Adrian, that's really a great question. Before I answer that, you know, I just want to get the basis covered, having a very brief introduction on what the mycotoxins are, right? So mycotoxins are a group of compounds, naturally occurring toxins really produced by fungi. And they have proved to have adverse effect on the health of animals and human. And so far, 25% of a common agricultural crops contain mycotoxin level that are higher than the legal limit. That's a huge loss of our agricultural product. And thinking about a chronic exposure has been shown to result in cancer, immunosuppression, and many other long-term pathological diseases, including liver cancer. Now, looking at what we are doing in this field, our approach is really a multi-pronged system approach to address mycotoxin risk assessment, right? So this means, mycotoxin risk management. This means we're really looking at how can we make improvement at every stage of the supply chain: prevention, mitigation, detoxification, and surveillance. it's really all over the place, right? But it's also what it requires to truly address it in a holistic way. So I want to just give you a quick example. What do we mean by prevention, right? So prevention means in the early stage, if we can use some cultivars or varieties so that they are resistant to specific risk factors, then it is less likely for them to have, you know, aflatoxin or mycotoxin challenges. Take peanuts as an example. We know that, you know, peanuts are very important commodities, but 47% of the edible global peanut supply is contaminated with excessive amount of mycotoxins, and therefore they're not really useful, not usable at all. So what are we going to do? So recently, Mars Wrigley have launched a partnership with Hassan Alpha to create a peanut variety that are less susceptible to aflatoxin contamination through optimization of genes for drought resistance. You know, it's a screening process so that we can identify the specific genes and then further enhance that. Now, this will benefit both human health and the economy. In terms of the linkage to climate change, I think it is very important to understand that climate conditions are the most important driver in the production of the mycotoxins. Humidity, temperature, and therefore climate change is really playing a huge role. It has already induced significant change in the distribution, the type, and the concentration of mycotoxins. One example in case is aflatoxin. We are seeing the shift of the band of aflatoxin to north. Before, it used to be centered around tropical area, but now it's moving further north. And this is a big challenge, and we have to address it accordingly. I hope using these examples, I demonstrate, you know, how mycotoxin work we do, how these new solutions will help improve our quality of products and address food safety challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, looking at some of the, I guess, you know, scientific studies that have been done about the possible effects from climate change, you know, it seems that things like, you know, the risk from posed by mycotoxins and you know, such as aflatoxins, would grow worse if we don't mitigate, you know, the rise in temperature. So obviously, with regard to food safety, that's something that, you know, scientists such as yourself really have to take a hard look at and be monitoring carefully and closely and constantly, because, you know, our food supply and our public health depends on it, certainly.
Absolutely. And in this case, it's really going for the worst, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for those insights. That's really important information, and we appreciate you sharing those insights with us. So I want to continue with that thread and ask you, you know, so in looking at how we can address this aflatoxin problem, what are some good agricultural practices that, for example, maize farmers can follow to help minimize aflatoxin contamination in high-risk regions?
Yeah, the good agricultural practice plays a very important role for maize farmers. And to this day, we can say that the biggest challenge is, despite the fact that we do have you know, GAP, short for good agricultural practices, they do exist today. However, they are so complex, make it really impossible to follow for our farmers and let alone to execute them. So that said, our aim is to simplify them by working together with experts in academia and also in the industry, in agriculture. We come up with a handful of suggestions on the good agricultural practices so that people can truly focus and make a difference. What we realized was we have to focus on the different stages. For example, pre-harvest, during harvest and post-harvest. So I just want to give you some specific GAPs. During the pre-harvest, just like I mentioned earlier, the use of drought-tolerant varieties of maize is very important. Now, during harvest, timely harvest is key. Sometimes it even means before physiological maturity is achieved in high-risk regions. It's almost a balancing act, right? Before you realize, do we choose high yield, maximum yield, or do we choose, you know, low level of aflatoxin? I think the answer is very clear. We want to make sure aflatoxin level is controlled. So that means timely harvest is key. Now, talking about post-harvest, that's extremely important. That plays a big role in the overall control of aflatoxin. First of all, proper drying is important. We need to control the level of the moisture to less than 13%, and that has proven to be very effective. The second GAP in the post-harvest is sorting. We use sorting to remove the damaged ears. The third GAP in post-harvest is storage conditions. It has to be stored in very suitable conditions, meaning it has to be clean and under conditions where there is very proper aeration. So these are the top five GAPs we summarized, and we have more detailed elaboration in our recent published paper. So what we have done is to share that through this journal, and beyond publishing it in a peer-reviewed journal, we have also established some training with FAO of the United Nations. We are working with them so that we can distribute these top five GAPs through local networks. But we strongly recommend we continue to raise awareness and improve the yield and reduce aflatoxins.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that information. And it's certainly interesting to hear that you're working on, you know, that training program for the GAPs with the FAO. And, you know, it's certainly with the report that FAO just came out with, looking at, you know, new food sources and all sorts of things and the food safety aspects of those. Lots of interesting information coming out along these lines. So again, thanks for sharing that information. So, you know, speaking of kind of partnerships and looking at other things that the center is involved in, I know that you participated in a food safety coalition workshop in May of last year to help shape action around food safety for the UN Food Systems Summit, particularly with regard to aflatoxins. So can you share a summary or tell us a little bit about the meeting outcomes from that workshop?
Very happy to, Adrian. We all know that 2021, the United Nations organized the UN Food Safety Food System Summit. This is a huge event, right? Understanding, you know, the ambition is really, really big. So it's about bringing together government, non-governmental organizations, so-called NGOs, and also the private sectors and civil society. So Mars was invited to participate in the UN Food System Summit CEO Consultation Group. And the focus of this group was to drive actions at pace. So we saw an opportunity to convene a coalition of like-minded organizations to unlock the scale solutions in food safety. And that's why we worked together alongside of academia, industry, and also NGOs to drive food safety actions to progress a long-term transformational food safety agenda. So the coalition team has already agreed to split into smaller sub-working group to develop actionable plans that can be driven at pace in the following area. There are a total of four work streams. I'm going to walk through them very briefly, one by one. The first work stream is about sampling and data analysis. What it does is to look at the sampling strategy and the best practice in different areas and in different organizations. We want to make sure it is done properly and also use this opportunity to collect data that is publicly available. In Workstream 2, it is about risk assessment. So think about this. We have collected a whole bunch of data. What does that data tell us? What does that mean? How can we convert the data into risk-related recommendations? So that's the main focus of Workstream number 2. Workstream number 3, it is about a predictive model that we have developed by working together with a university. This aflatoxin predictive model is a specific design for maize. So this Workstream 3 is about test and learn. We want to try this in a specific country and find out what are the main accomplishment in that and what are the main opportunities for further development. So that's the purpose of Workstream 3. Last but not least, talking about Workstream 4, it's about risk communications. So we realize there is a big opportunity to communicate and educate people. There are a lot of information out there. What is the right way to communicate and educate people? It will make a huge difference. Social media has now played such a dominant role. They will fill in information very quickly to guide them through science-based information. That will be the key. So I hope through this brief introduction, I give you some idea of what the Food Safety Coalition is trying to accomplish. And throughout the year, we are going to various conferences, including the upcoming World Mycotoxin Forum in May in Italy. We will share this work, and we plan to complete this work by the end of 2022.
Great. That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing all that information, Dr. Zhang. It's, you know, obviously very important work. And, you know, as we spoke before, the mycotoxin risk management is something that will scientists such as yourself are certainly keeping a close eye on moving forward, especially as we pretty much fail to control climate change at this point. So, you know, kind of moving on from looking at aflatoxins, I'd like to talk about another one of your center's focuses, and that's right. That's microbial risk management. So, looking at microbial risk management, what foodborne pathogens or pathogen-related issues is the center focusing its research efforts on at the moment? And you know, what has this research indicated so far?
I'm very happy to talk about microbial risk management. This is a very active area at the Global Food Safety Center. And I think it's important for me first to establish that food contamination, especially microbial contamination, has far-reaching impact. You know, it's beyond the public health impact. It also undermines the food import-export, tourism, livelihood of food handlers, and ultimately the economic development. So what we are doing in this domain is to drive research and collaboration to move towards faster detection, identification, and source tracking, and ultimately prediction of microbial contamination risks. So, you know, our goal is to really realize a shift. Before I get to that shift, I think it's very important to realize what people are doing today in terms of the food industry. Typically, they talk about how do we address microbial incident. When something happened, let's do something, let's fix it. Now, our goal is to move from that paradigm, a reactive paradigm, into a preventative and ultimately a predictive space, developing scientific capabilities that really help prevent microbial contamination to happen in the first place, right? Prevent it really from happening in the first place. And we want to enable a very robust supply chain. So the Global Food Safety Center is evaluating and testing new approaches can predict food safety issues. You know, next-gen sequencing and metagenomics have the potential to revolutionize how we respond and how we prevent these microbial food contamination. I think Mars was the first company, the global food company, to investigate the potential of utilizing this technology to help achieve rapid pathogen identification. Within 8 hours versus in the past, days and weeks required by traditional serology. What we did was we started from Salmonella as one of the most well-understood foodborne pathogens. And then we are now building on the work to expand the scope to build databases and the development tools for pathogens such as Listeria. I want to give you a very quick example. It's about a technology we are looking into actively right now. It's called Oxford Nanopore Technology, in short, ONT. So imagine a factory incident. When it happens, we need to immediately start an investigation. Previously, what people do is to collect sample, swab, and then send it to a lab. Now, hopefully within a 2 to 3 weeks time, typically, it could be even longer. 4 to 6 is not rare, right? And after that, your data will come back, but it really had very limited genetic information. Based on that information, then people make decisions. But now, using this Oxford Nanopore technologies, we have an opportunity to bring in the investigator with a handheld device that is the size of a Nintendo Switch and to run the samples on site in 8 hours instead of, you know, taking the samples to the facilities where we test things. We bring the solution to the sites. This shortened the distance and completely improved the efficiency. And I think all in all, what we're trying to do is to make these tools viable and accessible so that we can truly ensure safe food for all.
Wow, very interesting technologies that you guys are looking into at the Global Food Safety Center. And, you know, I know that you've also worked with some academic institutions to develop rapid identification for pathogens using whole genome sequencing. Can you talk a little bit about those projects and, you know, the results that you've seen from them?
Yes. If I may, to build off our previous discussion, you know, around Salmonella detection, we are working together with our partners at Cornell University and the University of Georgia. Together, we are exploring this ONT whole genome sequencing platform to run real-time serotyping of Salmonella. Another purpose of the study was to understand that the industry benchmarking of source tracking and genome to genome comparison. So by forming this wider consortium type of partnership, what we can do is to pull our knowledge and resources to ensure we develop the best possible methodology for portable whole genome sequencing. So the one aspect we didn't get a chance to touch upon is multiplex sequencing. Earlier, when we talked about the portable solution, we are really looking at a single flow cell. But as everybody in the food industry knows, sometimes the huge barrier between a good technology and a great technology is that it is just too expensive. How can we drive cost down? How can we make it truly accessible? That's when we, you know, take our strides in looking into multiplexing sequencing using the ONT platform. By combining these tagged pathogens, we can run up to 10 samples in a single flow cell. Think about that. But it's not only the numbers, right? We need to balance the accuracy and also the time it takes. In the end, we determine five samples on a single flow cell is the best way to move forward. What that means is the cost now can be reduced to 23% as to the cost of a single isolate analysis. So this is really a very important milestone. It dramatically reduced the cost and increased the efficiency, bringing us closer to enable routine analysis and really taking the solution to a much broader audience.
Interesting. Okay. And, you know, so I also wanted to ask you about the center's third focus, which is looking at, you know, technologies and methods for detecting food fraud, food adulteration. What kind of work is the center doing in that area?
The Global Food Safety Center has a long history in the food fraud area. And I think it is important to recognize with the increasingly global and complex supply chain, food fraud is getting more and more serious. So in order to address that, we have developed, we have investigated in two main techniques, spectroscopy and spectrometry. Let me explain a little bit more. That's a lot of jargons, right? So spectroscopy, that is infrared or near infrared, UV-Vis, this type of a technology, as you can see, is quite affordable. And it's also readily available with the right database in place. You know, we can use it in routine screening. And we can even make it portable and bring them to sites, factories, suppliers to validate the authenticity of raw materials. The way we use it is mostly for screening purpose, meaning we can see whether there is something out of the baseline, the outlier, that's when we realize something is going on, right? When that happens, that's when the second tier of tool come into play. The second technique we are investing is called spectroscopy. From the sound of it, it's really about a set of different mass spectrometry. We have to admit they are complex, right? They're complex. They're different level of complexity, and they're usually designed for lab use. But that said, we have developed fingerprinting techniques using a so-called ICP-MS, which is the medium level, right? Not so expensive, widely usable for the geographic indication of rice, so that we can tell whether it is from Bangladesh or maybe it's from China. Just use that as an example, right? So what we are exploring now is we want to make sure we have the right technology established for the right application. The custom-made approach will definitely maximize the usage of these techniques. And with that, we hope we can protect our supply chain from food fraud.
Excellent. Great information. Thank you for sharing that. So one thing that you had spoken just a little bit about earlier in our talk is the attention on new science and technologies, such as advancements in genomics and also tracking shifts in the food microbiome, which may provide great insights on trends in food safety and quality. So can you speak a little bit about the new research that's coming out in this area and what that's going to mean for the global food supply chain?
Yeah, Mars is really helping drive global innovation in genomics, food and agriculture, to enable critical breakthroughs in food safety. And new technological advances in the omics, the broad omics and the bioinformatic field have enabled the holistic study of microbial community structures and their functional activity within a given environment. We took part in what was the largest ever metagenomics study, and this was primarily used to categorize and understand the microorganism and the factors that influence their activity in selected raw materials and finished products. So with the ability to look at the health of the microbiome, let's say of a poultry meal or dairy powders, we can build a link between the microbiome health and food safety risks. The purpose is, before the onset of an incident, we can pick up on some early signals so that we can take actions to prevent things from happening. This capability will move the industry from a reactive to preventative and predictive space, as I mentioned earlier, right? And our work on microbiome, was cited, as you mentioned, Adrian, in the recent FAO Food Safety Foresight Report. It's a great honor. But we also understand in that same report, they pointed out one of the most basic and challenging question is, currently, there is a lack of consensus on the definition of a healthy microbiome. I think toward that goal, we will work continuously together with academia, NGO, and the industrial partners to address this.
Fantastic. And, speaking of working together with your partners, I know that the Mars Global Food Safety Center has many partnerships with industry and academia to share knowledge and foster these technological and scientific collaborations. You talked about a couple of those partnerships earlier. Can you share some other examples of other ongoing or recent partnerships that are working to advance the science of food safety at the pre-competitive level?
I'm very happy to share more information on our partnership and collaboration. And I think in reflection, when I first joined the industry, I think food safety is something just what we do, right? But each day passes, I realize this is something, it is so big, no single government, no single country can achieve this alone. And also we realize the industry has a critical role to play. What we can do is to help identify solutions and share information so that we can address these long-term food safety challenges impacting the global food supply chain. And collaboration is really the key. And as I mentioned, that's why we took the pre-competitive approach, and that's why we opened the center. We realize there is so much to do, but we have to start it from somewhere. I want to give you an example. In 2018, Mars Global Food Safety Center partnered with the Kansas State University Innovation Lab for the reduction of post-harvest loss, the Nepal Academy of Science and Technology, Nepal Development Research Institute, and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln to help facilitate a state-of-the-art mycotoxin lab in Nepal. The focus is really on understanding the problem of increased levels of aflatoxin present in the breast milk and blood serum of Nepalese mothers. So Mars Global Food Safety Center helped design the mycotoxin facility based on our own lab and the research center. We recommended some key pieces of equipment, and we also provided training so that the lab technicians, operators, supervisors are equipped with the right skills and the right knowledge. And certainly, we pass on the most advanced laboratory methodologies. Looking at the outcome from this specific work, now the aflatoxin levels have been analyzed through thousands of food samples in Nepal, and contaminated maize and groundnuts were identified as two of the biggest aflatoxin contributors within the Nepalese diet. What's even more exciting is the local policymakers are now looking to leverage these findings to design policies and program activities to tackle aflatoxins head on. I think this is really a great example of public-private partnership. You know, the laboratory design and the training, they could, we really see that as a blueprint, a model that can be further expanded to other US government-funded initiatives, such as Feed the Future initiative.
Wow, that's really interesting. And, you know, certainly the work that you completed at that center in Nepal was very important for, you know, detecting an issue that you know, will hopefully and ultimately lead to an improvement in public health. So that's a great example. Thank you for sharing that with our audience, Dr. Zhang. So, you know, speaking of looking toward the future, what research is the center hoping to advance in the future, you know, both through collaboration efforts or on its own?
Looking into the future, I just cannot get three things off my mind, right? And I'm exposed to that every single day. Digitization, data, AI. As we look into the future, digital solution will play a big role. COVID-19 triggered a wave of rapid development in sensors and devices. And translating into food safety, it means there are more handheld devices available so that in combination with digital data solution on the cloud, we're able to acquire large scale of data that would otherwise be impossible. Now, that naturally leads to the second topic, data. This is going to be revolutionary. When you think about it, the large amount of data will change the way we look at things. Instead of analyzing data in isolation, now we can harness all these data and identify the links, patterns, and trend so that we can make prediction and act before things happen. Isn't that something exciting, right? And the last but not least, artificial intelligence. I think many of us could say, well, I've heard that one before. What does that really mean? I think artificial intelligence in the context of food safety, we could interpret it in many different ways. I want to give you one example, which is something called horizon scanning. Horizon scanning basically is a process where people gather intelligence based on the information that is out there. Traditionally, this is mostly done through a much manual process. But now, with artificial intelligence, we are able to use machine learning in combination with automation, then we can pick up intelligence that is definitely not obvious to people. And we can train this algorithm so that it becomes automatic. This take out the human factor. It reduce the error to the least amount and is definitely more sensitive so that we can use these intelligence to drive action and make decisions. And certainly, I want to circle back to our three areas of focus. In mycotoxin, we talked about the aflatoxin prediction model. Can you imagine that when it's coupled with AI? You know, the data will be automatically acquired, and then a decision or a recommendation be made immediately. And thinking about the microbial risk, we look at the, you know, metagenomics, the change in microbiome, we can decide, oh, something is about to happen in this environment. We have to take certain cleaning actions. We have to do something about it. And last but not least, in the food integrity prevention of food fraud, using this method, we can pick up traits that is non-targeted that would otherwise be easily missed. And the artificial intelligence really could help us in a great way. To summarize, I want to say this. Food safety challenge will not cease to exist. I hope you're just as excited as I am when we look at the new technologies that are available to us today at our disposal for food safety investigation. However, I do recognize that there is still a lot more to be done. And that's why I want to reiterate at the Mars Global Food Safety Center, we believe education and awareness fueled by original research, knowledge sharing, and collaboration are very important. The open sharing of these food safety knowledge across food industry, combined with a collaborative approach to identify risk and solutions, especially for long-term food safety issues, can help demonstrate the positive societal impact industry can make.
I absolutely agree, Dr. Zhang, and I think you're right on with, you know, looking with excitement toward these technology advances and where they will take, you know, food safety and public health and, you know, environmental monitoring into the future, but then also knowing that in order to achieve that, we need more collaboration, more education, you know, training, all these continual things to keep working at it, sharing, you know, the information and making sure that we're aware of everything that is going on and sharing all of the information that we're finding out. So really appreciate you sharing your expertise with our audience today, Dr. Zhang. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, and we thank you for participating in the Food Safety Matters podcast.
Thank you very much, Adrian. The honor is definitely mine.
Thanks again to Dr. Zhang for joining us on the podcast today, and of course, thanks to all of you for listening. A very special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Michigan State University. Please visit foodsafety.msu.edu and then click on the master's program link to learn more about their Master's of Science in Food Safety. And don't forget, there's still time for you latebirds to register for the Food Safety Summit in Rosemont, Illinois, May 9th through the 12th. Please check out the full agenda and register at foodsafetysummit.com. Podcast listeners save 10% when you register using the code FSMPODCAST. And finally, please send us your questions or suggestions to podcast@food-safety.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We're always excited to get your feedback. And you know, you can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your podcast player by clicking on that follow or subscribe button in whatever player you use. And just like that, shazam! It's truly a little bit of magic. And while you're there, please throw some stars our way, because, you know, that's kind of part of magic, too. Stars and secret dust and things like that. That's a little bit of that. You throw the stars, it makes for a better spell. So, it only takes a minute. It's fun, as I've just described, and it's good for everyone. So, all right, that's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on May 10th. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.